This is the Car Dealer Podcast driven by CarGurus. You want the best return for your advertising budgets, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast. If you haven't listened before, we pick our favourite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me is not James Baggett or James Batchelor, because they're both on holiday. But as we are contractually obliged to have at least one James on the podcast at all times, we found another one, and I would say a better one, in fact. It's esteemed motoring journalist Jim Holder. Hello, Jim.
Hello. What an introduction. Thank you very much. I'll take that and put it on my CV immediately.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. How are you?
Keeping very well, thank you. It's busy time for everyone. Unfortunately, we don't get to go on holiday in August, but a lot of the industry does. And that means there's an awful lot of news pumping out and about at the moment.
Yes, certainly is. I should say to any listeners who hear any background noise, Jim is currently graciously doing this from a, let's call it a public area where drinks are served, because that's the only place you can find any Wi-Fi. So if there are any interruptions, don't be alarmed. But at this point, I would normally ask James or James how their week has been, but I sort of know how your week has been because I've seen about 3,000 people congratulating you on your new job.
Yeah, it's been quite a week. I was actually in Austria with a 110-year-old car doing a feature when the news broke. But absolutely, the news came out that I am joining Renault and their communications team, their brilliant communications team, from the start of September, which is obviously very exciting, a good change of tack, but obviously something I hope I can contribute to and learn from, and should be thoroughly enjoyable because the company is in such a terrific place with all three of its brands, Dacia, Alpine and Renault, with the products that are coming through and the strategies that they have to implement over the next few years. It should be an incredibly exciting place to be working.
I can see you've started already. You're ready to go.
I can talk about it as much as you want. I did a day there this week just to try and get up to speed. And absolutely, you won't hear a bad word from me. They're in a terrific place.
Well, I'm sure everyone at Renault will be thrilled to hear that. So just a bit of background for everyone listening. You, before this, you spent 8 years as editorial director of Autocar and Whatcar and Car and Sport, Classic and Sports Car, and Cat, I think, is the other one, isn't it?
You've done well. You've read down the CV. Uh-huh. So 25 years as an automotive journalist, 10 years of motorsport, 10 years of cars, vans, and other areas of the industry. But also, yes, those eight years overseeing all of Haymarket Automotive's brands, most of which you just listed. Piston Heads is the other one that people often forget that we had for a while, but absolutely following the industry from as close as I could get to it, really.
And quite some changes in that time, I would imagine, as well. Well, I say this every week, quite some changes in the last 25 years, but yes.
You don't want to sound too old, do you, and start harking back to the good old days, but absolutely a changing industry. Obviously, during that time, even things like the internet were invented. We didn't do emails when I started, and the pressures on the journalists and the story makers to just react in a different way, different speed. You know, I enjoyed that transition very much, and hope we represented it very well, but it brought its own challenges. And it's, you know, it's a fact the publishing industry is struggling to adapt. And at a time that the car industry is also having its own struggles, particularly around production, you know, it's a tough business to be in.
Certainly. Well, I will move on and introduce our guest, our other guest, technically, this week. And it's Phil Wannell, founder of AutoGenie.
Hello.
Nice to have you on, Phil.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So just for everyone listening, AutoGenie is a used car platform with a bit of a difference, isn't it? Do you want to sort of explain how it all works?
Yeah, so it was from a headache that I had as a car fan. I've been a long-time car enthusiast, and a headache that I had during COVID, actually. I really needed a car. No, I didn't need a car. I wanted a specific car, and it was quite literally hell trying to place that car on all of the existing marketplaces. I had to go in each individual advert, look at the fine details, see whether something was listed in the fine details. You couldn't drill down far enough in, basically, on any of the platforms that I was looking at. And the thought just came into my head, why can I not just fly a flag, tell everyone what I want, and then let them come to me? So they reach out to me and go, oh, actually, that car that you're after, I've got that in the garage, or that's sitting on my forecourt. So I had a look online. Nowhere did it. There wasn't a single solution online where I could do it. So my background with e-commerce, website management and development, I thought, I'll just do it myself. So I created AutoGenie, came up with the brand, and we launched officially in January, and we've got a few hundred dealers on board, and people can now place their requirements on the platform and get the car that they're after, which is a great way of doing it, because a lot of people that I spoke to do compromise on the car they're after because they cannot buy it. Certainly the enthusiasts, they do compromise on the car that they want purely because they cannot find it. So with AutoGenie, you literally can drill down to, you don't want glass rear quarter panels on your 911, you want the plastic rear quarter panels on your 911. So there's really specific things that you can go for. I was after a C63 AMG with a Harman Kardon system. It was quite a rare option. And on auto platforms that are currently around, you can't necessarily drill that far down. So you do have to go into each individual listing. So, yeah. And to sell the car, people just put their reg plate in. So they put
It's all automated beyond that point.
Yeah, you put your reg plate in, and then six people come up and say they're looking for your car. So it's reverse selling. It's basically flipping all of the current models on their head and turning them upside down and doing that.
Fantastic. So what sort of things are people traditionally looking for? I mean, obviously you've used a couple of examples there, but what is it people are really desperate for in terms of the options? What do you see the most of? Is it things like stereos, or is it paint colors, or?
To be honest, we've got stuff like certain history. So there are cars with certain history. You know, we've got people using the platform for Maseratis that are specifically requesting no sticky buttons. Because the sticky buttons on Maseratis are actually a thing, after a certain age, they get sticky and they cannot be replaced. They have to be refurbished. So people are physically writing, I don't want anything where there's an issue with that going on with the car. I want a specific service history. I want less than these miles. I want it garaged. I want a car that's been garaged throughout. Ferraris and things like that, where people are wanting to collect it, but they want to garage it. They want to know that the car's been garaged previously. You can't do that. Other platforms won't allow you to drill down that far. So it really is for the collectors. I mean, we've got Bentleys being asked for, we've got Ferraris, Maseratis, Golfs. So we've got a large range of cars currently on the platform being requested. And it will hopefully just enable people to save time, because you don't have to keep looking on all these platforms. You can put one request in, walk away, go and see the family, spend time with the family, work. You just have to, you can just get on with it. And then the car that you're after will eventually come to you. AutoGenie, you make the request and it appears.
Rub the bottle, etc. How'd you get a GP?
This is it. Yeah, make your wish. Make your wish. And that's really where it came from. I mean, I've had three cars that I had a very specific one in mind. And it was just hard work. It was just hard work. I mean, one of them was just an S-Max, but it was a top of the line bi-turbo, certain mileage. And it was really hard to find. And it was constantly, daily on the internet looking for it. And if it's not on one of the platforms, you've then got to go to each individual dealer's website.
So predominantly, is it, you've mentioned some pretty high-end stuff there. Are people on there looking as well for like Ford Fiestas, but they want the parking pack, say, which was on option and not necessarily on all of them? Does it drill down to stuff like that as well?
It does. It does go all the way down. We haven't got an influx of that user base at the moment. We have only launched a couple of months back. So we're finding that we are going for Shadow Edition BMW 140s. We're going for that type of thing on the platform at the moment that is a little bit more exotic, but not terribly exotic. And I'm hoping that eventually, yeah, it will be your Golfs and your Ford Fiestas and your whatever it may be, your Punto. So that's the goal. That's the goal for us to be able to capture that audience as well.
So with the kind of shortages on stock and delays on new cars and all this sort of stuff at the minute, is that sort of encouraging people to look for a used car that ordinarily wouldn't have looked for a used car, and therefore you're getting this very specific person that ordinarily would have specced up their C63, as you say? Or are people being a bit more flexible because they know they're not necessarily going to find the spec they want because it's a used car?
Yeah, I think, to be honest with you, that is part of what's been sort of drilled into people over the years. Because, I mean, let's be honest, we've had 40 odd years of purchasing cars the same way. So that's been a long time for people to follow the same process in terms of buying. So when they can't immediately find the car that they're after, they may not panic buy, but they may just go, do you know what? I'm not going to find what I need. I'll compromise on that and I'll reach out and I'll buy the car. We do have more people, I think, buying secondhand cars purely because a lot of the, well, we had initially, we had a massive shortage, didn't we, of components for new cars. So we saw an uptrend when that became a bit of an issue for new cars. But new cars are pushing very high end or much higher end now. So with the new cars, they are coming out at your £80,000, £90,000, £110,000. And the used car market is flooded. So you've got a huge volume of used cars for people to purchase and buy into at the moment. So,
and what's your background, Phil? How did you, obviously we know how you came to sort of start it. It was a bit of a problem you're finding yourself, but are you automotive industry background yourself?
No, I have always loved cars. As I say, I am a bit of a car fanatic and have been since started driving at the age of 17. And the e-commerce background, basically, I've sold headphones and audio equipment since I was 16, 17 again. So I've had a background of e-commerce and website design and website building and management. So for me to be able to do this myself has been a massive asset because I haven't relied on massive developers and things like that. It's purely been sort of myself and a small team of people to do things that I couldn't quite do myself. The algorithm, the matching algorithm is my logic, but someone else had to design that. So
Interesting. So yes, I suppose your first thing you were looking for was definitely a car with a decent stereo then.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was LSD. It had to have LSD because, again, that was an option on the car, and the rare Harman Kardon system. And that just made the car even rarer. So I'm hoping that will keep the value of the car a little bit higher than the bog standard at C63. So here's hoping anyway.
Absolutely. Well, I will get into our stories then, because I'm sure we have a lot to discuss this week. If you haven't listened before, Jim and I have chosen our favourite stories from the car dealer website this week. We don't know what each other has chosen, and we're going to have a chat about each story as we go through. At the end, Phil gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. If you want to play along, you can tweet at car dealer, sorry, you can X or whatever it's called now, at car dealer mag, and let us know if you think we've missed anything. I am going to go first, just to ease on my new co-presenter in, and I'm going to start with Lookers. So there's been some ongoing Lookers news over the last few weeks. There's been a takeover. Well, there's been two takeover bids now, both by Global Auto Holdings, who are the sort of bidding company for Alpha Auto Group, which is, I believe, a Canadian dealer group. So they put in a bid a few weeks ago, 120p per share. That looked like it was going through. Then there was some sudden news that it was not going to go through, it looked like, because various shareholders weren't very happy with that amount of money. In the meantime, we had a bit of speculation about what was going to happen next. Was Lithia Motors going to come in, as they have been saying they're looking for further acquisitions after their Jardine purchase and so on? Was anyone else going to swoop in? What has actually happened is Global Auto have increased their bid to 130p a share. So that values Lookers at £504.2 million, which is an 8.3% increase on the previous recommended offer. Fans of maths will realise. What we don't know yet is whether that's going to go through. So it's been put forward, but it's all kind of, we're in the same position as we were before, where we're waiting for shareholders to give it the go-ahead, effectively. But the directors they've agreed to the recommended cash offer. So, Jim, I don't know if you've been following this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Following it, I think it's intriguing at the moment how much movement and how much interest there is in car dealers. Obviously, you know, they've been enjoying record profits, but everyone is slightly on tenterhooks for how long they can last, and we've certainly seen a little bit of softening these past few months. But it is interesting just how hot these companies are, particularly when some of the sort of more hotly channeled internet retailers attracted such big valuations before. I know a lot of car dealers were privately quite put out that their established profitable businesses were not attracting the same kind of interest. But, you know, we can see it time and time again, you know, what hot property car dealers are and what values put in them. And in a way, that's lovely at a time when you've got things changing for them, and the way cars are sold is being changed. And you know, from a new car perspective, at least, a lot of manufacturers are looking to change the way they operate with the agency model. You know, these investors clearly have faith that the money will keep coming in.
Absolutely. Confidence in the physical dealership, in a way. I mean, it's interesting, most of these, well, all of these have happened from outside of the UK, haven't they? They've generally been takeovers from Canada, or I believe it was Sweden that Lithium is from. It seems to be outside countries that are bringing in these investors, which would suggest perhaps, as we've said before, that yes, everything's perhaps a little bit undervalued in the dealer world.
Yeah, I think we have traditionally underestimated the UK car dealers and the job they do. I mean, it's been very easy to knock them and not so easy to celebrate them. But these are the sort of deals, particularly, as you say, when people are swooping from outside, that really underline their value.
Bill, have you been watching this particular story?
No, but that the money is certainly there, I think, from foreign countries. I definitely think they see the influx of money still on the agency model, which is interesting. From what I hear from dealers and things like that, and them changing over to that model, I think it's going to be rocky for a period, certainly.
I mean, we have also heard various kind of people have told us that companies, manufacturers who are introducing agency, if you've got a dealer group that represents a lot of those manufacturers, that sometimes calls into question the value of the company. I mean, Lookers has a broad portfolio of manufacturers to represent. Presumably quite a lot of those will be going to agency, either we know about it or we suspect. But that doesn't seem to be impacting this quite so much. We could also talk about, considering Lucas's previous troubles, that all seems to have been put behind them. So positive news for Lucas, isn't it, really? Well, I will move us on to your next, well, your story, Jim.
Yeah, time for me to make a play for some points. I was going to talk about Cazoo. Obviously, I hinted about them. Now I'm going to talk about them directly. And the fact that they've been on the Watchdog show yet again this past week. I feel a little guilty for bringing them up and mentioning them again, but they did put themselves on this pedestal. They did go in all guns blazing when they arrived in the industry. They made some pretty derogatory remarks about the established players in the industry. And I think when they came in, what actually set them apart was this absolute focus on a Trustpilot score or similar, where it was all about the customer service and delivering good customer service, and almost in the narrative, at least, at the expense of chasing profits. And I like that. I like the fact that they serve the consumer so well, and that they promised to give this amazing experience, which I think is so critical to that online sales journey. But it's been chipped away time and time again. There are examples. Absolutely, I take their point that they've sold more than 100,000 cars. And here, Watchdog is highlighting the experience of two customers. But if you've got problems, you have to fix them, and you have to fix them quickly. And that's really not what's happened here. You know, you can't boast about your 300-point check before selling a car if there are then failures further down the line. So here we are, Cazoo in the headlines again for the wrong reasons, you know, being increasingly exposed as perhaps no better than the traditional car dealers, and perhaps not even as good as a lot of the traditional car dealers. They really need to find their feet and get back on the front foot somehow, and stories like this just don't help.
I know what you mean about feeling guilty for bringing up a story like this, because as you say, this isn't the first time they've been on Watchdog, and you can't really pull out isolated incidents like this and say that, you know, as they say, they've sold hundreds of thousands of cars. Occasionally there's going to be a problem, as many car dealers find. But have they set themselves up for failure by claiming all this fantastic customer service stuff? Is that why? Do you think they're being made a bit of a target by Watchdog on the grounds of, is it the successfulness of the name, and because their name is everywhere, it's just a, why should Watchdog pull out them as opposed to Arnold Clark or anyone else that somebody might have had an issue with once upon a time?
Yeah, I think it's back to my original point, and I'll be interested what Phil has to say about this, but you put yourself on a pedestal, you're there to be knocked off. You know, they came in, they spent a lot of money. They were incredibly disruptive in generally in a good sense, but also in a slightly over-swaggering sense, you might argue. And if you're going to, you know, if you swagger into a room, you've then got to carry it off. And I think there is an element of that they are now paying for that profile that they created for themselves.
Yeah, I think it's very much if you live in a glass house, don't throw stones, maybe. When they came into the market, as you're right, it was very much everyone, we're here. This is where we're going to sort of feature and spend our money on the customer journey and make sure that everyone is happy. And that was what was going to set them apart online. That was what was going to set them apart. So as a USP, if their USP is failing, then that is something to speak about, sadly. And they are a big player, and there are going to be people that do want to tarnish them, sadly. So I think it's Watchdog will take these. Did you say there was two customers?
In this particular thing there's two customers, but yes, there's been
I mean, people get things wrong, and I think sometimes companies can get too big. And the people do, or customers can get lost, sadly, in the ether. It's a case of getting that person to the correct person within management quick enough to get issues resolved. And I think sometimes the lower agents don't escalate quick enough to get these types of things remedied. And I've personally had that, sadly, with a dealership, and it took myself 13 months, 14 months before they actually escalated it to who needed to see the issue. And then it was resolved in a month. So
Jim, on a wider point about Cazoo, since you're here, you've spent quite a lot of time in consumer publications talking to consumers about their car buying journey and all this sorts of stuff, haven't you? Much more than we do. What is the sort of sentiment, you think, at the moment in terms of buying cars in the way that Cazoo deals with them? I mean, it is, you could call that a full end-to-end transaction in a way, couldn't you? Because they either deliver it to your house or you have to go to a place to collect it, but you can't go and test drive it. This is a, you know, what's the consumer sentiment on that sort of thing? Are people not really wanting to do that now the pandemic is, I don't want to say over, but now we're back to our weird new normal?
Yeah, I think it has transformed and it is transforming, but it's definitely a roller coaster with ups and downs. We've certainly used to measure the sentiment quite heavily, and there's no doubt that during the pandemic, the sentiment towards it surged, but it has dipped again. Now the doors have opened. But I would say there is still an increasing number of people generally willing to look into it. I think particularly a certain type of car buyer, 3 years old or less, typically, cars that still have a warranty on them or are only just out of warranty. I think people are less concerned, in the mass market, particularly about that test drive. There is a faith and a belief that they will be reliable, that there won't be problems, that these 300 point checks will have picked up anything that they need to be aware of. I think consumers like internet shopping in general. They worry about some of the hurdles that it then presents further on, but I do think there is this general movement towards it from a subsect of car buyers. It's not for everyone, and I'm not sure it's, well, in fact, I'm absolutely sure it's not for the majority just yet, but there is an opportunity there, unquestionably, and I think it will keep growing. But, we are talking about a subsect, not the majority of car buyers.
So we still need clicks and bricks, is the phrase, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And back to your story before, not that I want to give it too much credit, that's where the interest is, and that's why these big players are still looking at those opportunities.
Interesting. Right. I will move us on to, and I'm thrilled to be talking about talking to someone other than James about this. Genesis have opened their first UK showroom outside London. So this is in Edinburgh. It looks jolly nice, I have to say. This is the third UK studio. They're doing all this with an agency model, as we know. I think this was talked about last week. And there's various other studios in development with various other dealer groups: Arnold Clark, Ancaster, Hendy, Holdcroft, Pendragon, Richmond, Sinclair, various other ones. I wanted to have a general chat about Genesis as a whole. Really, I just wanted to ask Jim, what are your thoughts on Genesis? Because whenever I try and talk about them, because I think the products are very promising, James disagrees. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
It's a good job James is on holiday, because I'm going to agree with you. I've spent a lot of time with Genesis, and I've spent a lot of time both driving their cars and looking into the brand. I would have placed the EV60 as one of my cars of the year last year. The GV60, sorry, which is an EV. I thought it was an absolutely terrific car. I take the point that, it's built on pretty solid foundations from the Hyundai and Kia family, but I thought it offered something genuinely different and refreshing compared to the sort of Germanic premium rivals. I felt that particularly the interior stood out for both its design and the opportunity to have some nice bright colours and different materials. And I actually welcomed them hugely to the market just for doing it differently and offering an alternative. I know others have tried and failed, and I look at Genesis's, try saying that when you're sat in a public space. I look at their sales figures and registration figures, and you worry for them in the UK to an extent, but they are growing exponentially. They do appear to be incredibly committed to the market. They are investing in all the right ways. I think it's really interesting that they've moved very quickly to finding retail partners rather than trying to do it all themselves, which I suspect is a recognition of an issue they were having when they were trying to do it themselves, and I think is yet another feather in the cap of car dealers. And I hope they continue to grow. So next time I see James, I shall take this up with him.
Yes, because I think he likes to point back to Infiniti and point out that they didn't last terribly long. But the difference with Infiniti, as we know, is Infiniti arrived with products not really designed for Europe, I think is the first thing. You know, they arrived in the era of diesel with no diesels. That was not a great start. And I think they didn't put a huge amount of time and effort into marketing and all this sort of stuff, I think, whereas perhaps Genesis is throwing a bit more Korean dollar behind it. You know, they are sponsoring all these various events, aren't they? Not to do a kazoo, but they are pushing themselves out there. I mean, I do hope they succeed, really. I mean, can you see them succeeding?
I absolutely can, if you're asking me. I think Infiniti arrived with a bang that petered out really quickly. I think Genesis are in it for the long term. I think they've got the might of the Hyundai Group. I know Infiniti had the might of the Nissan Group behind them, but I think Hyundai Group tend to plan very long term. I think the only pity for me was that they didn't arrive with an all-electric lineup. I think that would have been bold and made a statement, but I understand why they didn't. And I think they do have a bright future.
Phil, what do you reckon? Would you buy a Genesis?
On branding alone, which I've seen an awful lot, I mean, their marketing department is definitely on point. Whether it's, I don't know whether they've got a UK honed marketing department or whether it's from HQ, but yeah, definitely on point. I mean, branding is brilliant, which would make me buy one. I would definitely go and get a Genesis for sure. I don't want to say the T word in terms of how they're doing it, but they're definitely getting exposure, which is great.
We'll be right back. You want the best return from your advertising budget, and CarGurus Piston Heads are focused on the same goal. With them, you have access to millions of monthly shoppers across both sites. Connect with in-market, high-quality buyers today and turbocharge your digital forecourt. For more information, visit dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and schedule a demo with their team. That's dealerpackages.cargurus.co.uk and tell them we sent you. Now, let's get back to the quiz.
Back over to Jim.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to try and continue the positive theme. I'm going to talk about JLR and their profits. Obviously, we are at the time of the sort of half-year profits all being announced. But JLR haven't had a lot of good news on that front for a long time. And I thought it was very significant that their latest figures were so good, £435 million of profit, just under 100,000 cars sold. I think crucially, 76% of them were accounted for by Range Rover, Range Rover Sport and Defender, their most profitable models. And I think that subtle, in some ways obvious shift to prioritising orders for their most profitable cars at a time when they are still fighting this chip shortage, has led to some very significant gains. I think it's also interesting, the sales are up 30% year on year, but the revenue is up 57% year on year. And, this is shifting the more profitable models. This is proper sort of luxury tactics, trying to get some, the more optioned cars down the lines. And I think, you can read it either way, but having such a massive waiting list, I think just under 200,000 cars now, it points to the struggles they had during the chip crisis. And if you want to be brutal, the failures they had during the chip crisis, they seem to be more badly affected than almost any other car company. But they now have that order bank to really enjoy and to be able to protect profits. You used to be able to get discounts definitely on Jaguar products, but even on Land Rover products. When you've got that kind of order bank, you do not need to be offering customers incentives to come to you. And we're watching the company. Of course, we're watching the company. They're undergoing this transformation. There's a lot of noise around the House of Brands strategy and what that's doing for it. But I think if you've got an underlying profitability to your business, you can do a lot more and you can have a lot more credibility with some of your more extreme decisions than you will when you haven't. So it's great to see that fundamental appears to be back in place for them.
I'm going to add some more noise to the House of Brands discussion now, which is just around this figure of Defender, Range Rover and Range Rover Sport are 76% of all orders in Q1. I mean, that actually seems relatively balanced, but if you think about it, that means 24%, if my math is correct, is Discovery Sport, Discovery and Range Rover Evoque and Velar. So actually, there's quite a few models in that small 24% left. Can you see, I mean, to me, it's Discovery, as I've said before, that I think is the slightly orphaned child by all of this, because I just feel like they've got very strong brands in Defender and Range Rover, as we know. I think it's Discovery where they're going to struggle. Where do you stand on that? Do you think Discovery is a strong enough brand by itself in this House of Brands thing? Or do you think they're very good, quickly going to discover that actually discover that Discovery is not as strong as they perhaps thought it was? Oh, you're on mute, Jim. Sorry.
I think we have to look back to where the Discovery was and not judge it on where it is. I think the current Discovery was always a bit of a stopgap, and there were even faint hints of that when they launched it. They knew that without a Defender on sale at the time, they had to try and do something different with Discovery to sort of span two parts of the market. And I think they've ended up, you know, as so often when you try and spread yourself too thinly, you don't appeal to one side or the other. I have always had this sort of suspicion from the twinkle in his eye that Jerry McGowan has something up his sleeve for Discovery. And I sincerely hope that turns out to be the case. I think it can do. I think people used to talk about the Disco, with very fond brand associations, a very clear understanding of what it could do. They absolutely need to find that space again, and it's not in that space now. So I completely agree with you that it's a potential weak spot. But I also have some faith that they can do it. They do seem to nail it when they have an absolute focus on the market they're trying to talk to. I take your point around Velar and other vehicles that haven't always quite hit the mark, but I get the feeling Disco, if it's refined in its mission, can deliver on being a brand.
Well, I don't envy them. Phil, what do you think?
No, and I think the Defender 90 and 110, I mean, they've walked away with it, haven't they, in my opinion? I mean, once that was released, it just went up for the group. It's such an amazing vehicle, really. I think that's really set them apart in a land where sort of people were looking at Euros and things like that, that now have their own clientele, and the Defender is a very different user base, and I think it's definitely stolen the heart of that fraternity. So it's a great movie.
Sounds live you were, Jim. I mean, my only fear with it is that, as we know, the Defender has cannibalized Discovery sales. You could argue, is that because the current Discovery is not actually, I don't want to say it's not very good, but it's not kind of carving a niche for itself in quite the same way that the Discovery 3 and 4 did. I think a lot of customers have gone to the Defender from there. But maybe they can reinvigorate it, as Jim says. Good luck, Jerry.
I think the Defender's just got a lot of heritage, isn't it? You've got a lot of people that love the very original, the Mark 1s and Mark 2s and things like that. And you've got people that are invested in the new ones because they loved the old one, and that's I think they've got a lot of purchases from people that were probably still driving around in the Mark 1s and Mark 2s, and they were like, "Well, I'm going to get a new one now. I've had it for so many years. I'm just going to get a brand new one." So, whereas you haven't really got that with the Discovery. There's not that pedigree there, sadly.
Well, I shall move us on to what should I go for? I'm going to go for the 2030 ban on new petrol and diesel cars, something we will be talking about probably every week until 2030 or 2035. But this particular story is about a little bit of wobbliness from the government in terms of whether this is actually definitely going to go ahead. Obviously, 2030 is a long time away anyway. But there's now a bit of suggestion about whether the government might flip-flop on this slightly, which is not ideal because, as we know, we like a bit of certainty in general, as does the car industry. So this has all come about. There was various interviews going on yesterday where it perhaps wasn't as clear as day as to whether the 2030 ban was definitely going to happen. And, you know, I think whether this is just because we're talking about something many, many miles away and various MPs don't want to commit in their usual politician sort of way to something happening. But there's a suggestion that perhaps the 2030 ban is, this is to quote the Sun's political editor, Harry Cole, on Twitter. He said it's now a matter of active discussion in number 10 unofficially as to whether, I assume, as to whether it will go ahead or not. I don't know whether, I think as far as I'm concerned, it sort of needs to happen now. I don't think you can flip-flop around in quite the same way. And we've been saying this, and people in the industry have been saying this for months now. You can't say, you can't put this sort of goal in for 2030, tell everyone that's the case, and then kick it down the road. I think manufacturers will be setting themselves up for this particular deadline. It might seem an unachievable deadline, but you've decided that's when you're going to do it. You can't then turn around and go, actually, I think we might do it 5 years later because we haven't put in enough charge points. It's a sort of, it's a cheap way for, if the government were to move this goalpost, I think that's a cheap way of dealing with the issues of putting this goal in place rather than actually putting a rocket up their backsides and actually sorting out the charging infrastructure and so on and so forth. But Jim, I'm sure you have some things to say on this.
I do. I think it's utter idiocy to try and move it. I think you have an entire global car industry here. And if you think you can take Britain out of step with the entire global car industry and maintain 750,000 jobs plus ancillary suppliers and so on and so forth, I think you're deluding yourself. I think we committed to the date. It's in line with where a lot of the rest of the world is going. There is some wriggle room between 2030 and 2035 because no one has yet defined what constitutes a substantial electric range. You know, I can understand if they want to try and use some of that space, but if you start flip-flopping, you start offering a bit of wriggle room, you are just going to be left behind. You know, we know car manufacturers develop vehicles on 7-year cycles. They are already building 2030s cars now. They are already investing billions in R&D into that technology. If they can't make a return on that, then they won't keep going. The whole process falls apart. You know, we've seen this week some amazing announcements around the amount of money being invested into charging infrastructure, which is one of the major concerns that keeps getting brought up. You know, actually, the truth is that the main barriers are coming from things like planning regulations, from some of the red tape that the government could be removing if it would just focus on the problem. You know, this all stems from announcing a date without a plan on how to reach that date and not putting any kind of industrial strategy behind it, not really showing any recognition that they understand the challenges that are there and how to overcome them. You know, actually, in recent months, actually talking down the transition that they themselves instigated. I think probably there is an element of sensing it could be a vote winner at the imminent general election within a sort of certain segment and demographic. You know, we've seen how they like to weaponize certain situations, absolutely. And I think they sense an opportunity there, and I think it's sad and it's cynical. And I think you either commit to something or you don't. You don't run into no man's land and then change your mind halfway and go back to your trenches. What it needs is the doubling down on planning, strategy, all the basics that the government really should be delivering. It does not need to be rowed back upon.
Yes, just to drill down into that, because it's 2030 for petrol and diesel and 2035 for hybrid, isn't it? But as you say, there's not really a strict definition of what constitutes a hybrid. You probably know more than me on this. Is it they've decided a set, it has to have a significant range? Is that what they've said?
I think you've nailed the phrase exactly. They've decided that without determining what a significant range is. Where, you know, is it 3 miles as you would get from a Prius, or is it 30, 50, 70 miles? And I think, you know, in a way, I appreciate that, you know, this may need a little bit of wriggle room. You know, some people believe it won't, but I, you know, if the transition needs a bit of wriggle room, I'm quite comfortable with that. But I think they've set the framework for that wriggle room to start trying to redefine it, you know, many years after setting it out would just be lunacy. And I hope, frankly, we don't need the wriggle room. I don't necessarily see why we are. You know, we've got to remember, this is only the registration of new vehicles. Used vehicles will still be available. A lot of the cars that are sold in 2029 or even up to 2035 will still be on our roads by 2050. You know, when you're as old as I am, I'm not even sure I'll live as long as all the combustion engine vehicles coming off our roads. So it's a long way away. And if they could just put a plan behind that transition and work out how they're going to make it work, it could work. I've no doubt it could work.
Bill?
Well, I'm going to cause some controversy right now because as far as I was aware, Europe themselves have revoked the ban for 2030. So it's the whole of Europe that have said we're not going to ban petrol and diesel vehicles from 2030. And they have said that if it runs on e-fuel, then it's okay to be sold. And the UK was steadfast that no, that's it. All vehicles that were ICE were going off the road at 2030. So I think now there's pressure from Europe, because Europe themselves have wobbled on it and gone, well, actually, if it's an e-fuel and sustainable, Porsche, I think, are the people that are pushing their e-fuel tech, which will be very easy to push to all of our garages, effectively, and because the infrastructure is still there. I think that's why there's a wobble now in the UK, because of what Europe have been saying in relation to the fuels.
I'm going to come back on you on that one. You are absolutely right in what you say. I think e-fuels probably can work for a minority of cars. I don't think it's a simple solution. I don't think it's necessarily the greenest solution by some margin. It's certainly at the moment an expensive solution, but you know, who are going to be using these e-fuels? The high-end car makers, the people who own Bentleys, the people who own McLarens. You know, we have a very impressive niche high-end industry in the UK. So I would agree with you absolutely that the UK stance to rule out following Europe and allowing e-fuels is absolute madness, because these car manufacturers need to be able to take advantage of these rules. But they are absolutely, in volume terms, on the fringes of the solution. I think the mass market solution still needs to be electric. E-fuels need to be part of it. For the UK to just stand against Europe for no logical reason and say we're not going to allow e-fuels, you know, why would you do that? Why would you endanger these thriving businesses that we've developed?
Yeah, and that could be why there's this flip-flopping, as you say, in government at the moment, because if there's an all-out ban at 2030, that would also incumbent your e-fuels and Porsche, and you don't really want to be upsetting those guys, to be honest.
I mean, we should say the e-fuel amendment, as it were, to the EU regulations, I think that was heavily pushed by German car makers, wasn't it? And as we say, it's about, as it stands at the minute, 6 or 7 times the price of petrol or something like that. Obviously, there's no infrastructure at all. No infrastructure, because there's big petrol tanks in the ground and petrol stations, but there's not really a massive network of places producing this e-fuel at the minute, is there? And of course, it still produces, because it is still fundamentally petrol, it's just sort of produced in a different way. It still pumps out all the same NOx and various, you know, particulates. It's purely that the CO2 element is offset by the fact that it's been dragged out of the atmosphere to make it, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yes. But interesting times. I believe it's Jim now, if you've got any stories left.
Yeah, I've got a few left. Keep going, but I don't want to overrun. Right, let's talk about UK car production. Gosh, another phrase that's hard to say in a public establishment. Up 11.7% over the last 6 months of the year. 450,000 cars produced in the UK over the last 6 months. That's featuring a 13.6%, sorry for all the numbers, surge in exports. And I think, you know, that's what you have to remember about car production. 8 out of 10 vehicles built in Britain are exported, nearly 60% of them to Europe. And I think you have to have that global picture in your mind when you talk about car production. We should be proud of the car industry. It's an incredible benefit to our country that it thrives so much and that it contributes so much, both in spending in the UK in terms of R&D, but also in terms of the money that it brings into the country. So to see it growing again after the pandemic is encouraging. Obviously, it still has a long way to go to reach pre-pandemic levels. It's about 33% down on where it was. But I think we have to be mindful, you know, and this is not to deliver any judgment on Brexit whatsoever, but we have to be mindful that 60% of what we build is going into Europe. And that is particularly crucial for electric vehicles and the transition to electric vehicles, because when we did the Brexit deal, we agreed these rules of origin regulations that mean if we're not building our own batteries, it's almost impossible to avoid all of these tariffs that will be put on our vehicles. And if we can't avoid those tariffs, we have an uncompetitive industry. So there is a huge amount of work really to try and undo some of the agreements that were made, make them more practical, and to maintain Britain's position in that global market. And obviously, the JLR news, the Tata news around the battery plant was great, but we need five more of those announcements, probably by 2030, certainly by 2035, just to maintain the industry we have. So some great news, but we need to be mindful of the knock-on effects.
Yes, the battery plant, or lack thereof, is definitely the elephant in the room of this, isn't it? It's people have been warning that this is going to be a problem, and we can wave goodbye to our entire car industry if there's not enough battery plants in the UK. I mean, I was thinking to myself, who have we got that have actually, we've got Toyota, we've got Jaguar Land Rover, we've got Nissan. Nissan have sort of sorted with their own little battery plant, aren't they, which they have committed to expanding. That was the first battery plant in the UK, of course, for the Leaf. I can't remember off the top of my head if Nissan have committed to making more EVs in the UK as yet. I'm sure they will do, but I can't remember any specifics, because the Leaf obviously will be going out of production at some stage. You've got Stellantis up in, I've forgotten the name, but they've got Stellantis van plant where the Astra was. Currently, the batteries for that are coming from not the UK, obviously, so they're going to need something for that. I mean, can you see this actually happening? Can you see us sorting this out in time?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is it is possible to move batteries around the world. It's neither economic nor, you would imagine, environmentally the best way to do it, but many have been doing it. Stellantis have plans to do it. It is possible, but if you want to do it properly and you want to avoid these tariffs, you really do need these homegrown battery plants. Can we do it? I think you have to remember every, you know, it depends how big it is, but a gigafactory is probably at least 2 to 3 years of building. It's probably the same number of billions of pounds of investment to get it up and running. Those decisions need to be made. They really needed to be made years ago. They certainly need to be made very, very quickly now. It's a shame. It's a shame that we're clinging on by our fingertips in a best case scenario when we could have been at the forefront of this. You know, it's back to my earlier point of having a date without a plan. Why would you commit to a battery car only future without knowing how you are going to supply those batteries? And it's that kind of slightly bigger thinking. It's not huge thinking, is it? We could all come to that conclusion ourselves, yet our government hasn't. And that's what the frustration really is.
The interesting thing for me with my fag packet maths, I mean, in many ways, it makes sense for JLR to set themselves up a big gigafactory here, because of course they are a British manufacturer predominantly, apart from making things elsewhere as well, but they're a British car company, aren't they? But to me, because it's something like 60% of the value, isn't it, has to be, or 40%, I can't remember, 60% of the value has to come from the UK or the EU in order for us to skirt under these tariffs. JLR probably is one of the companies that probably could afford to, if we're talking about value of the car, I'm assuming, does it go on list price, or does it go on the value of the raw material going into it? That's my question, because if it's how much is a battery versus how much is a Range Rover, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot on top of the cost of the battery in a Range Rover. There's much less on top of the cost of it in, say, a Peugeot Partner van, isn't there? That's going to be mostly battery and not much else. So it's, in a way, a slight surprise that JLR was the first to do it, but then maybe it's not really, since they are British in the first place.
Well, we have to remember, you know, they were looking at Spain. They were very much tipped to go to Spain. They were willing to take on that challenge, and it was only a very large last minute injection of cash, we'll call it, from the UK government that really appears to have swung it in the UK's favour. So as you rightly highlight, you know, these decisions are not inevitable, and you have to fight for your position if you really want it.
Phil?
Yeah. Well, I think, again, it goes back to the government. I mean, they need to, as you say, they need to invest and grab these opportunities to keep these people on shore. And with, I mean, the previous topic about, well, we don't know now, we're flip-flopping with electric. But like, what are they doing? They need to make sure that there's things in place. Nothing's going to change so that these companies can actually invest in these things without the fear that they're never going to need them. The incentives from the government to do it and keep it on mainland, really, it's not happening enough. So,
well, is it my go now? Yes, right. I am going to go for Renault. You'll be thrilled to hear. Renault and Nissan, they've agreed new terms on a partnership. I'm just muting Jim there. They've agreed new terms on a partnership set to invest more than £500 million in it. So this is a new EV and software entity within Europe. So this will be shared between Renault and Nissan. I don't know why I'm talking about this, really. I'm the wrong person to be talking about this, but I've chosen it, so I will carry on. The other interesting thing for me is Renault have scaled back their stake in Nissan. So Renault and Nissan have this sort of slightly complicated arrangement, which I couldn't possibly try and explain within the podcast, but they own bits of each other. It's an alliance. But Renault sort of, as I understand it, own a bit more of Nissan than Nissan own in Renault. Because at the time that Renault bought Nissan, set up the alliance, Renault was a bit of a stronger car company than Nissan, as we know, in the Carlos Ghosn era. But this has been a bit of a sticking point for Nissan, allegedly, over the years, that perhaps Nissan is, you know, owned partially by the a French company, and therefore the French government, I think, have a stake in Renault. So Nissan have not been too thrilled about this. So Renault are now reducing their stake to 15%, making them equal partners going forward, which I think is quite interesting. So you could look at that one of two ways, couldn't you? One is that Nissan have finally got their own way. And the other way is that actually Nissan have sorted themselves out now since the 1998 or something like that, when Nissan bought Renault. Renault bought Nissan. You see, it's very complicated, this. Jim, I'm going to hand it over to you now. Did you write it, please?
No, I definitely. So let me remind you that I don't start till September.
That's right. That's
Jim
right.
Holder, the journalist speaking, not Jim Holder, the soon-to-be Renault employee.
Correct.
I think, look, it has been a complicated relationship. It has been at times an incredibly tense relationship. And we know that it reached, you know, a boiling point with the saga over Carlos Ghosn's arrest. You know, there are lots of subtext there around Nissan becoming increasingly frustrated by Renault's dominance in their affairs. I think what you have to see, though, is the positive here. And I know you'll expect me to say this, but you have to see that when Luca de Meo became the boss of the Renault group, he inherited an incredibly fragile relationship with Nissan. It was both complex, it was divided, there were huge challenges within it. And what he's done in fairly short order is not only get Renault back on a sound footing from a very, very desperate situation. You know, their profits came out for the last 6 months, and they were staggeringly good. They've got an incredible product line coming up. Renault in great shape, but he has now managed to carve out a working position with Nissan, where everyone is happy. There is both an equal share with one another, but also they can see where the complementary parts of those two companies are. You look at Nissan and you look at some of their investment in autonomy and some of that future tech. I would imagine, and I only imagine, I do not know, that that is the sort of stuff that Renault is looking at. When you look from the Nissan side, you must look at Renault's dominance in the European market, that some of their products is particularly appealing. So some of the electrification work that they've done on both sides is surely going to be in the middle of that Venn diagram. You can see how it can be complementary, but you know, the best of friends have become the worst of friends, and it appears they've found ground where they can get on once again and go forwards rather than squabbling. And that has to be good news, and is absolutely all credit to the senior management on both sides.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because when we forget this, but when we look back at the fallout from the Carlos Ghosn affair, the immediate impact of that was everyone was panicking about the alliance, weren't they? And he was seen, rightly or wrongly, as the glue that held the alliance together. And with him gone, are people going to start to tear it apart? But you're right, that doesn't seem to have happened. And in fact, they are perhaps happier now. Well, certainly happier now than they were then. But yes, the perhaps more Renault-y angle of this that they would, I'm sure, like me to talk about is the investment in $500 million into this new software and EV entity, which is sort of to say they're suddenly stuck. Well, okay, so I think I believe the Aria and the Megane E-Tech, whatever it's called, I think they are sharing some bits now, aren't they? Whereas before, if we go back to the original Leaf, bizarrely, Nissan designed their own one, Renault designed their own one, and there were no shared parts between the, as I understand it, the Zoe and the Leaf, which is sort of madness in a way when you think about it. I can understand why they did that, because Nissan had spent decades before the Leaf playing around with EV technology, as manufacturers have done in secret, I'm sure, for years. And they had their specific way they wanted to do it, and Renault did the same thing. But I remember when I went to a Nissan thing in Japan a few years ago, I remember them saying, well, we're now going to combine the two things and we're actually going to share technology. And I thought, well, why on earth haven't you been doing this in the first place? This is, you've been had an alliance for the last 20 years. Why is it only now that you've decided to do this? But yes, good news, I think. Good news. Phil, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, from a software development background, I mean, I think it just makes a lot more sense. R&D costs alone to do two separate ECUs effectively and infotainment systems is horrendous. So as you say, if the corporation is, or cooperation is already there, utilize it, bring it all together and invest more money on one single product that does a better job potentially, and then move that across all the platforms. That And also for users, it's going to be a lot nicer, because you'll be able to jump in a couple of cars and you'll understand what's going on with the interface and how it's working and everything else. So I think certainly from an end user point of view, it should be a great benefit.
Mm. I mean, that's how they've differentiated themselves from Stellantis here, because that's the Stellantis situation, isn't it? You pop into any small electric car from Stellantis now, perhaps not the 500, but most of them feel very similar.
Mm. Is that a good or a bad?
Well, debatable. Yeah. I would say all electric cars feel very similar in a lot of ways.
Yep.
But Renault and Nissan have still gone their own way with things like hybrid, haven't they? Nissan's got their own way of doing it. And they've borrowed the Renault way of doing it for things like the Duke. But it's strange that they've done that, I suppose. But that is the joy of an alliance versus owning each other. Jim.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, what a great story to end on. but here we go. What are we going to choose to round us out here? Why don't we talk about car finance and Auto Trader's news that actually the rising cost of finance isn't putting car buyers off in great numbers, which I find astonishing, if I'm brutally honest. I think they're now saying the average APR rate is 8.4%, which is up 4.5 percentage points on where it was. You know, from where I'm sat, it sounds terrifying. The language they're using is that there's just a softening in demand as a result. Now, you know, we keep looking at inflation, we keep looking at recession, we keep skirting around the economics of a situation. And there does seem to be this pent-up element of savings from the pandemic, where people are still spending money at a faster rate than anyone thinks possible.
Incredible, really.
It is incredible. And certainly, you know, when I think of my own finances, you know, you may see that I've gone slightly green while I'm talking about this. I'm a little bit jealous. But the bite really doesn't feel like it has you know, gone in as deep as people are expecting just yet. You know, slightly terrifyingly, that's just there might be more to come. But if you're a car dealer, you know, it feels that there is still optimism around a part of the market which many predicted by this time of year, and certainly in the months ahead into this year, would be softening rapidly. You know, it's enjoyed such strength, the used car market. I think a lot of people back in January were predicting that it would have softened at a much faster rate than it has. And it seems that even these incredible rises in interest rates, you know, I think that's probably my basic maths would suggest more than half over the course of the year. It hasn't put off as many people as they expect. People have got used to things costing more and seem to be still have the money and presumably the savings rather than the pay rises in order to be able to keep up.
I mean, yeah, I struggle with this slightly as well, because I look at all these figures and I think, well, you know, as someone with a mortgage, you notice the differences, don't you? But perhaps, I mean, I think partially there's the element of how much of it is done on residuals in terms of payments and so on. And that has, obviously, residuals have been a lot stronger recently, so that has helped. The other thing is, I think a lot of people, car finance is an incredibly complicated area to try and understand. If you're a new car buyer, you sort of, I would imagine the majority of people just go in. This is what we hear from people. They have their set monthly payment. This is what they can afford. And they work it out from there. They're not actually too into the nuts and bolts of the APR and so on and so forth. And obviously that has an impact on their monthly payment, but they perhaps don't notice it in quite the same way. All they know is their current car is running out in three months' time after their 3-year agreement or whatever, and they need to find something else, and they will find whatever it is that fits the bill of being X amount a month. But you're quite right. I am surprised that some of the rises have been so high, particularly on even on new cars. You've seen some tremendous monthly price increases, and the price of cars is going up as well. You know, like I saw something about the Vauxhall, the new Astra, electric Astra that's come in. The monthly payments on that are quite significant because it's a £40,000 car, effectively, electric Astra. So I can't remember the figures off the top of my head, but I remember kind of raising my eyebrows at them. And I think that's the case across the board. But yeah, I'm surprised that this hasn't resulted in some sort of impact yet. But as you say, it could well be coming. It must be coming, because we've been sat here for 3 months going, well, where's this downturn? I mean, you hope it won't come, but I'm sure it will.
Yeah, it feels like a bit of a bubble, doesn't it? It does feel like at some point it has to pop. But I think you do make great points. We are slaves to our desire for personal transport. We have a budget. You know, you can adapt that, the type of vehicle you have, according to that budget. And you're right, the strong residuals have helped maintain those monthly payments at a good level. But, you know, there is something absolutely disbelieving about it when you look at the fact that an average car now is north of £40,000, that even a common family hatchback has gone up in price by, you know, nigh on 30 to 50% at least. If you add in the cost up front of electrifying that vehicle, you know, you're suddenly starting to look at not far off double the price of what you would have anticipated you'd pay just 3 or 4 years ago, frankly. It just feels staggering. But people are still buying these vehicles. The car manufacturers are still clocking record profits. The car dealers are still making extremely healthy profits. You know, we live in this capitalist society where it's all about making the money. If people keep buying the cars and they're happy to pay those rates, so be it.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think we've all the consumers are now kind of used to increases everywhere. And you then look at your car finance, go, that's increased. Oh, well. It's just another, we need our cars, we need to do it. It's not not always a luxury. It's a necessity for many people to have a car on the road. And you just have to swallow it, I think. It's across the board. Anything you're doing now, there is an increase. And I think we're just so in the mode of the automated mode of going, okay, it's gone up, okay. You can't really do much about it. It is what it is. So,
Well, on that note, I think that's the end of our stories. So, Phil, are there any stories you think we've missed this week? Inevitably, because I've got some open in front of me that we haven't talked about.
No, I think that's covered. It's such a wide variety of topics as well. So I think that's been very good.
Excellent. So I'm going to have to ask you, who do you think is the winner?
To be honest, for me, it's the JLR story with the back orders, just because it's a positive bit of news. It's great. All the others seem to be a bit doom and gloom. But yeah, the JLR and their back orders, fantastic story. Love a bit of positivity on a Friday afternoon or Friday morning.
Well, I'm going to call that beginner's luck, Jim.
I'm logging on to Auto Genie now. I think it's terrific websites. I will endorse this at every future opportunity.
You, Jim. Thank you.
A great choice of winner, I would argue.
Well, on that upbeat note, it's time to end. All that's left for me to say is thank you to Phil for coming on and judging today and
chatting
away to us. It's been lovely to have you on.
Thank you
as well to Jim for joining me in the hot seat and taking my trophy. and all the best, Jim. I hope you can look forward to James ringing you twice a week to ask if agency sales have yet been implemented at Renault UK. So prepare yourself for that one.
He has my number. I have his number. I'll be blocking it shortly. Thank you.
If you're listening on Spotify, don't forget you can swipe up now and vote on who you think won. We'll be back next week with another episode, so make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories we've mentioned today, you can click the links in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk, where you'll find those and much more news besides. Thanks again, and until next time, goodbye.